here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Welcome back. Today is Friday, April 14th, and I'm Andrew Seal.
And I'm Sharon Nadeem. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscasts and podcasts on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5 o'clock and time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news.
This week, we're starting the show with a live interview with Madeleine Lalonde, the NDP MLA candidate for Vancouver Quinchella in the upcoming provincial election.
Thanks for joining us, Madeleine.
Thanks for having me on.
So why don't you tell us a bit about yourself and why you're running in this election?
Yeah, absolutely. My name's Madeleine Lalonde. I'm running in Vancouver, Quinchella. I'm a 22-year-old recent graduate from UBC. I'm the youngest candidate running this time around. The reason I'm running is pretty simple. There's a lot of reasons, but it really boils down to two things. I just got so fed up with Christy Clark and the BC Liberals and how they're treating everyday British Columbians. And then my other main reason is that I think it's time for young people's voices to be more representative in the political processes, and that means at every level.
Didn't you first get involved with the NDP here at UBC?
I did. I joined the UBC NDP Club on my first day of school, or not even the first day, at Imagine Day. I ran into an old friend and he told me to come out to an NDP social, and I got involved really fast, and it's just a bit of a slippery slope of involvement from there.
Yeah, and now you're hopefully going to be elected.
Yeah, that's the dream.
On your website it talks a lot about youth getting more involved in politics. How do you plan to encourage that, and what kind of role do you think places like UBC can play in that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, young people with voting has always been a huge issue for me since, you know, whenever I talk to young people, I know that they do care and they want to get more involved. The problem is parties aren't tailoring their platforms and reaching out to young people where they are. Like, their platform points aren't attracting young people, which is why I'm so excited to work with the BCNDP to have a platform that specifically addresses young people and students and their issues. And that's a big part of engaging more young people in politics, as well as just, you know, making it a more normal thing. By running a 22-year-old, it helps just normalizing the fact that young people care about politics, having normal conversations instead of being like, wow, it's so great that you're here, you're a young person. When you're really just saying it's weird that you're here, it's weird that you care, which is so disengaging. So making sure that the dialogues around young people and why they want to or don't want to vote is brought upon by other young people, and it's encouraging dialogue instead of discouraging.
Yeah, so do you think that, you know, the, like you said, parties haven't really been, catering towards youth issues and encouraging youth involvement. Do you think that's on them, or is it just that they've think youth aren't as interested?
I mean, I think it's a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you're saying young people don't vote, so why would we cater our message to them? But they're not voting because you're not catering their message to them. Yeah. It's a bit of a back and forth there. I don't know which one came first.
Yeah, so there's certainly a lot of issues in this election that affect youth.
Mm-hmm.
One big thing is housing affordability. So on that, what would you like to see done to ensure youth and particularly students can afford a place to live?
Yeah, well, in our platform that we just released on Thursday, we actually talked a lot about housing. It's a pivotal issue in this election since housing has gotten so unaffordable. One of our plans is to build more affordable housing, 114,000 rental and co-op homes in metropolitan areas. We want to make sure those homes are near transit. And with that, we want new student housing to be built by removing all these unnecessary rules that prevent universities and colleges from building this affordable student housing. Another thing we want to do is make sure that when you're renting, your rental is secure. So we're doing a $400 rebate. We're closing the fixed term lease loophole. And we want to put forward legislation that requires fair treatment when there's renovations and demolitions for the tenants.
So, yeah, housing affordability, or I guess affordability in general, mm-hmm. for students is often also linked to tuition costs, which mm-hmm. have been going up in recent years, especially for international students. What action on this could we expect to see from you and the NDP, or like what's the priority here?
Yeah, so we want to make all current and future BC student loans interest-free. We are going to introduce a $1,000 completion grant for graduates of colleges, universities, and trade schools, so we don't want to exclude any kind of schooling in that spectrum. We want to cap tuition fees, eliminate fees for adults and basic education and ESL, and then we also want to introduce more scholarships specifically for people looking to pursue grad school.
Oh, yeah, that sounds pretty great to me.
Yep. That's what I said. We're meeting people where they're at. It's about catering to young people, and that's how we're going to get young people voting this time around.
And so another thing that kind of plays into tuition, housing, student issues is transportation. Mm-hmm. There was recently the Broadway SkyTrain extension announced. Yeah. A lot of people were hoping it would go further, but at least it's moving down to Arbutus. So this was, I guess, not initiated by the NDP, but what are your plans for that?
Yeah, I think, well, investing in transit is so important. We want less cars and more buses on the road, or SkyTrains, you know, whatever kind of transit, which goes in with so many other issues like accessibility, the environment. And I think it's really important to be investing in services that people care about, including transit. And yeah, so that's really important to the NDP. And what we want to do as well is the federal government has offered about 50% for investing in transit. And so we want to match that and move forward with those plans.
Nice. So if the NDP, provincial NDP, is matching the 50% from the federal government, that would cover the whole cost then?
Yes, unless I did the numbers wrong there. Was it 40% and then the municipal said 10%? Let's not get all numbery. It's going to be fully funded with all the, yeah.
So you said before, like, you were kind of fed up with Christy Clark and what... what has been happening under the BC Liberal government for the past, I guess, 16 years now?
Yep.
It's a long time. So, yeah, what I think it says on the NDP website that she's not been working for British Columbians. And so, yeah, who has she been working for, and what's she been doing that, you know, drove you to get involved in politics?
Yeah, to me, it's really apparent that she's working for, you know, the top 2% and then also corporations. We're seeing the people who are funding her campaigns and her campaign promises are getting, you know, the services that they want. We're looking at the Kinder Morgan coming in because Kinder Morgan donated a ton of money to her. I think it's very transparent that she's not working for everyday people. She's working for corporations. And, you know, a big part of the BCNDP platform that excites me is that we want to ban corporate and union donations. So we're looking after everyday people's interests instead of corporate interests. And what really motivated me is just being a normal person living in British Columbia. Yeah. Like, I pay rent here. I know it's way too expensive. I've seen a million buses pass me when I was trying to get to school, when I try to get to work. Like, it's gotten to the point where you almost have to be conscious of the government around you because you get daily reminders about how hard it is to live here.
So what would you consider then to be the biggest difference between the NDP and the BC Liberals? Or alternatively, like, what would be the first actions that the NDP government would take to, I guess, undo or change what the Liberals have been doing?
Yeah, I think our biggest difference is who we're working for, to be honest. Like, we want to make British Columbia more affordable for everyone. We want to increase access to services that everyone cares about, create a sustainable economy with good, long-lasting jobs, and all these part-time and precarious jobs that are out there. We just want a more affordable life that's fair for everyone. I don't think that's a crazy claim, but it seems to be that the BC Liberals think it is.
So if you're going to increase, you know, in investments in, you know, transit and housing, mm-hmm. Where will, I guess, the extra funding for this come from? If you want to also make life more affordable for the middle class and lower classes. So I guess increasing taxes heavily wouldn't be the best option.
Yeah, well, we do have a fully costed budget online, so I can't speak to the entire document because we'd be here for a really long time.
Of course, yeah.
But, you know, a lot of our things are built right into our platform points. For example, putting a 2% tax on absentee spectators based off of where they pay their income taxes would go directly to funding the housing affordability. You know, we're looking at cutting back a lot of the wasteful spending that the Liberals have implemented, the, you know, LNG wasteful funds, hiring someone to go around and survey land. I don't know what he does, but he's being paid a lot. It has to do with LNG. So just removing a lot of the wasteful spending that the BC Liberals have done. And like I said, our entire platform is fully costed and online.
Cool. All right. So we just have a few more minutes left. One thing I was kind of thinking about is when you were talking about how Kinder Morgan donated a ton of money to Christy Clark.
Mm-hmm.
And so how, if we cut all corporate donations from, I guess, to political parties, like, how would that change? I guess maybe this is a silly question, but how would that change, like, you know, election campaigns and things like that? Would it make it more low key, or would it just make it more like, I guess the idea would be to make it more personal, I suppose, or like, you know, just less corporate.
Yeah, I mean, it would mean we'd be campaigning on what people want because we're relying on them to fund our campaigns.
And how do you plan to promote transparency? You're going to have, if the NDP is elected, they're going to be working within a framework that was set up by the Liberal Party,
mm-hmm.
and they'll have to change that. Like, how can you, there's been so many cases of people always saying, you know, we're going to promote a transparent government, but it doesn't always happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a lot of it is just being accessible. So I know the MLA in my riding, people haven't heard from him in 4 years. He doesn't even bother putting out a newsletter to his constituents. So being accessible to the public, actually, you know, standing by your constituent office hours, and having, you know, third-party sources come in and look at the books that the Liberals set up, make sure that there's no lying and cheating in their budget, which I'm sure it's there's less surplus than we're told there is, for sure. But to me, transparency has always been one of my key values, and I would be so disappointed if it wasn't reflected in the mm-hmm. way we ran government, mm-hmm. and I know that a lot of my colleagues would be as well.
Absolutely. So, just before we run out of time, do you have anything else you'd like to add or touch on?
Just that, you know, it's important to get out there and vote. You can vote anytime now at a district electoral office, and then definitely make time May 9th. I know the May 9th date is super disengaging for students since a lot of them are leaving and going home. So mm-hmm. just spread the message that you can vote now if you want. And if you want a more affordable BC, vote for the BC NDP.
Great. And where can people find out more information about you and the NDP?
Yeah, so I'm on all the social medias. So my Facebook is Madeline Lalonde, BCNDP. And for everything else, I'm MADILALONDE. I'm on Snapchat, Twitter, Instagram. There might be a few more in there. It's the thing about being the young candidate. You have to be on all the fun things.
Yeah.
I'm on Reddit, too. I'm doing an AMA on Tuesday at 7 p.m.
Nice. Well, if any of our listeners have any questions that weren't addressed tonight, then I guess they should head over to the AMA on Tuesday.
Yeah, it's going to be a fun time.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us and good luck in the campaign.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Madeline. We'll be back with this week's headlines after a quick PSA break.
One, Saturday, April 15th, a fundraiser for Girls Rock Camp Vancouver is taking place in the Grand Lux Hall of the Western Front, located at 303 East 8th Ave. Tickets are available at Zulu Records, Neptune Records, and both Red Cat Record locations. There will be raffle prizes from Anita Sikma, Nimbus School of Recording, Live Nation, John Fluvog, Tea Leather and Wood, The Juice Truck, Pizzeria Barbarella, CITR, and many more. Doors are at 6, show is at 6:30.
I was a prisoner.
Cocaine addiction.
Cocaine took my drink. It made me lie, steal.
Cocaine took my will, my soul. And all I wanted was more cocaine. Cocaine Anonymous gave me freedom and saved my life. If you got a problem with cocaine, pick up the phone. We're here to help.
Contact Cocaine Anonymous toll-free by calling 866-662-8300 or find them online at ca-bc.ca.
Welcome back to News 101. Here are this week's headlines. In campus news, UBC has approved a plan to replace the current meal plan system with a more expensive option. The main change is the transition from the current three-tier system to one mandatory and more expensive meal plan, which will take effect September 2017. With a total cost of approximately $5,500, the plan is $350 more expensive than the varsity plan and $1,200 more than the minimum plan. Colin Moore, director of food services, says that, quote, one of the biggest things that we heard was that there weren't enough meal dollars on the current meal plan to cover two terms. We want this new plan to meet as many students' needs as possible and provide them with enough meal dollars to eat for both terms. However, students are not impressed with the new plan so far. When food services evaluated the comments on a petition concerning UBC's current meal plan, they found that food cost and quality were two leading issues. Not having enough dollars on the meal plan was also an issue. Marcus Lee, one of the petition's organizers, pointed out that that the two main problems Moore addressed were not properly addressed by the new plan. Sam Bunka, another organizer, added that switching from three options to one option is not accommodating the diversity of students' diets or budgets. Moore encourages those with further questions and support to contact their enrollment services professional. UBC is set to vote on a new sexual misconduct policy. This comes in the wake of allegations that it mishandled complaints against a PhD history student and former creative writing chairman Stephen Galloway. If it passes, UBC will become the latest school to implement guidelines ahead of a May deadline set by the BC government. Genevieve Cruz, president of the Graduate Student Society and a member of the history department, helped write the document. She said the community was deeply affected by the complaints that the university delayed taking action on multiple reports about a PhD student, adding that, quote, putting together a policy is definitely a part of healing, unquote. Like many other universities in Canada, UBC has lacked a standalone sexual assault policy, which has led to miscommunications and months-long delays in previous cases. A new policy would establish centralized sexualized violence prevention and response offices at UBC's Vancouver and Okanagan campuses. The offices would receive reports, refer complainants to support services, and, if requested, provide information about the investigation process. In addition, the university will annually publish the number of disclosures and reports it receives, as well as the number of reports investigated.
In local news, local venue Vancouver Art and Leisure is searching for a new home after being forced out of its current mainstream location.
The locally run art gallery and music venue. In local news, local venue Vancouver Art and Leisure is searching for a new home after being forced out of its current Main Street location. The locally run art gallery and music venue was unable to negotiate an extension of its tenancy and given notice to vacate its premises by the end of May. Prior to Vancouver Art and Leisure, the location served as the base for the Vivo Media Arts Center, and the address has been in continuous use for cultural production for the past 25 years. The collective's executive director, Matt Troy, highlights that the group situation is not an isolated incident, recognizing a pattern in the disappearance of creative spaces around the Mount Pleasant area. Quote, this is part of a larger debate about how our city must move forward to preserve cultural locations for artists, unquote, adding, quote, gentrification of these presentation spaces is a major issue, stripping artists of places to hone and develop their craft, unquote. Troy hopes to host gallery and music shows at pop-up sites while the collective secures a new home, noting that this is not the end, but rather a new chapter for the collective. Events will be scheduled every weekend until the end of May at its current location. Vancouver City Council has approved sponsoring two massive bike rides this summer. Last April, a similar but unsanctioned overnight bike ride run was held by volunteers and drew in around 700 participants. The unanimous decision supports the idea of community gatherings and will hopefully combat Vancouver's no-fun city reputation. The events are expected to cost $250,000, which staff says would cover most of the traffic, route planning, engineering, policing, and other event-related costs. Our City Ride is slated to take place in August, while Bike the Night will take place in September. Collectively, these events are intended to attract 20,000 cyclists. NPA Councillor George Affleck, who has been a critique of Vision Vancouver's approach to bike lanes, said he supports funding for the cycling events. Quote, "For me, startup funding for something that could generate revenue for small businesses in the city, for restaurants and for tourism, it's all good." Unquote.
In national news, the Liberal Party has released its long-awaited bill to legalize marijuana. The pot plan comes with two new bills, one to regulate the recreational use, sale, and cultivation of marijuana, and a second that strengthens the measures against impaired driving. It would allow people to possess up to 30 grams of dried or fresh cannabis and sets the minimum at 18 years of age to purchase, though provinces and territories can set a higher legal age. Consumers will be able to grow up to four plants at home or buy from a licensed retailer. Dried and fresh pot and cannabis oil will be available first, with edible products to become available later. The new impaired driving bill creates three new offenses and gives police the authority to require saliva tests for drivers suspected of being high. Police can administer a test based on signs such as red eyes or the smell of marijuana. Justice Minister Jody Wilson-Raybould called it an important day and said the legislation aims to strike a balance between protecting minors and keeping profits away from organized crime. A Newfoundland ferry stuck in ice for over 24 hours near Quebec has gotten an escort to port. Crews are assisting the ferry that has been stuck in the ice-choked waters near Quebec. The Canadian Coast Guard tweeted Friday afternoon that an icebreaker is escorting the Apollo ferry to port after being stranded near Blanc-Sablon, Quebec, since Thursday. The ferry departed from St. Barbe on Newfoundland's northern peninsula Thursday morning, but the normally less than two-hour trip to Blanc-Sablon was delayed when the ship got stuck in ice in the Strait of Belle Isle. The Coast Guard sent an icebreaker to help the ferry, but says it could not help the vessel due to a mechanical issue. An operations manager with Labrador Marine Incorporated says all 70 passengers on board the ferry are safe, food is available, and there were cabins for people to sleep in overnight. Dave Layden says the delay has caused a major disruption to people's travel plans over the Easter weekend. Canada's honorary citizen, Malala Yousafzai, is challenging Canada to lead on women's education. The teenage Nobel Prize winner, who famously survived a Taliban bullet in 2012, delivered an enduring message of hope, perseverance, and inspiration on Wednesday, and did it as an honorary Canadian citizen. Yousafzai received the honor during a long-awaited ceremony on Parliament Hill alongside Prime Minister Justin Trudeau before an audience of dignitaries, MPs, cabinet ministers, and diplomats. 19-year-old Yousafzai, known to most simply as Malala, gave an eloquent and thoughtful speech to a joint session of Parliament. "The man who attacked Parliament Hill called himself a Muslim, but he did not share my faith. He did not share the faith of 1.5 billion Muslims living in peace around the world. He did not share our Islam, a religion of learning, compassion, and mercy," she said. Quote, "I am a Muslim, and I believe when you pick up a gun in the name of Islam and kill innocent people, you're not Muslim anymore," unquote. The gunman shared the hatred of the people behind the attack on the Quebec City Mosque in January, the attack in London 3 weeks ago, and the attack on Pakistan Army's public school in which 130 school children were killed, she said. Yousafzai urged the federal government to put its upcoming presidency of the G7 to good use. Quote, first, make girls' education a central theme of your G7 presidency next year. Second, use your influence to help fill the global education funding gap. You raised billions of dollars and saved lives when you hosted the Global Fund Replenishment in Montreal last year. Show the same leadership for education, unquote, she said. The other five honorary Canadian citizens are the Dalai Lama, the Aga Khan, Nelson Mandela, Burmese activist Aung San Suu Kyi, and Swedish diplomat Raoul Wallenberg. What binds them all together is that they are leaders who have played iconic roles in world history, says Chris Alexander, the former conservative immigration minister who oversaw the technical process behind getting Yousafzai Canadian citizenship.
In international news, China has issued a stern warning to the U.S. and North Korea over rising tensions in the Korean Peninsula. On Friday, China urged both countries not to push their recriminations to the limit and allow war to break out. Earlier in the week, the United States deployed a naval strike force to the waters off the peninsula. They were joined by several Japanese warships in a move designed to deter North Korea from conducting further missile and nuclear tests. In addition, the U.S. military has been conducting large-scale military exercises with South Korean forces, which the North considers provocative. Despite this, reports suggest that North Korea is preparing to conduct a new nuclear test. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi warned both countries of the consequences of war. Quote, if they allow war to break out on the peninsula, they must bear the historical responsibility and pay the corresponding price. In the event of war, multiple parties will lose and no one will win, unquote, he said. Human rights campaigners in Chechnya have claimed that gay men are being sent to camps where they are subjected to torture and beatings. According to a Russian newspaper, more than 100 men who are suspected to be gay have been rounded up and at least 3 people have been killed. The Novaya Gazeta reported that some men caught in the roundup were handed back to their families with the expectation that their family would kill them. Chechen leader Ramzan Kadyrov's spokesperson denied the claims on the grounds that no one in Chechnya is homosexual. Quote, you cannot arrest or repress people who just don't exist in the republic, unquote, spokesman Alvi Karimov told Interfax. The Kremlin-backed republic is strictly conservative, with a majority of people who are Sunni Muslims, and gay people who reveal their sexuality often suffer discrimination and are shunned by their families. The Russian LGBT network has said it had set up a hotline for people seeking help. The network claims to have received reports of the abuses and torture inside the prison through the hotline. UN experts have condemned the killing and torture and demanded that Chechnya halt their actions. In London, queer activists and members of the LGBTQ community staged a protest outside the Russian embassy.
Those are your campus, local, national, and international headlines on News 101. After a quick PSA break, we'll have UBC researcher and graduate student Yangfan Zhang joining us in the studio. He's going to be talking to us about his recent research on aquaculture.
Thousands of opinions are at our fingertips, but are all opinions informed? Does your information have a source? Is your social feed based on fact? Only facts can uncover the truth. Professional journalists are committed to balanced and nonpartisan reporting, to independent commentary. They cut through the spin to give you the information and perspective you need. Journalism is essential to democracy, a watchdog over the powerful, an independent voice. Journalism is more important than ever.
I'm going away. Look into my eyes. The last Sunday of every month from 11 to 5. Won't you hear with me at the Wise Hall, please? Wise Hall, please.
Welcome back to News 101. We now have UBC researcher and graduate student Yangfang Zhang joining us in the studio. Thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So why don't you start by telling us a bit about yourself and what it is exactly you're doing here at UBC.
So I am a PhD student in Department of Zoology. So I come from a comparative physiologist group. We particularly looking at fish physiology components. And then because in the BC and this local aquaculture industry is a huge economic drive, so a heavy part of my research program focus on the aquaculture and how to use the scientific knowledge in fish physiology and apply them on the aquaculture industry and improve the animal welfare overall.
So just to start off, can you explain what exactly aquaculture is?
Oh, aquaculture is a farming industry. Instead of farm crop as a traditional one, we farm fish. By meaning to say farm, we grow the fish in a controlled environment, neither on land or in the ocean. So currently, these are two major production way to grow fish. And one of iconic species for aquaculture in Canada is Atlantic salmon. Mm-hmm. So it goes through the first land-based facilities to reach a smolt. And then afterwards, they will be transported to the ocean for 2 to 3 years, grow to a market size about 5 kilos. So this transfer between land-based and the seawater.
So just, so you're saying that the fish then, they go to a land-based facility, but then they return to the ocean. But is it contained so they can't, like it's within some kind of a farm or whatever, so they can't just swim wherever they want?
Correct. Yes, and they would be a contained net pen system, so they won't be able to escape. Mm-hmm. And if they escape, they will be in the other environmental concern for sure.
Right.
So everything is contained, but the water was exchanged with the ocean.
Right.
By
right.
Currents.
Okay. And so how did you get into studying aquaculture and I guess your broader research project?
Oh, I get into aquaculture actually can date back to my undergrad research. So I did my own thesis on a fish farm, and that kind of take me into this aquaculture pathway. Mm-hmm. And then I choose to study the physiology component. And then UBC has the best professors. So this is why I move all the way from Dalhousie in the east and down to the western coast.
Oh, okay, so you came specifically to UBC for this?
For this. And because it's a perfect spot with good physiologists and good aquaculture industry around this coast.
Yeah, so in your the overview of your research, you're talking about how aquaculture now is responsible for about half of all the seafood that people eat, which means it's really important. So how do you, you know, and one problem also that you're looking into is that toxicants and pollutants are getting into the water supply and contaminating and affecting fish, right?
Right.
So how do you keep these domesticated fish that in aquaculture free of toxicants that are affecting wild stocks if they're also, because they also live in the ocean, right, just in a contained environment, so they must get the same water and things like that.
Right.
How is it that affected?
So it really depends on the site of aquaculture sea pen. So when a site was built, they choose to be in a sort of quiet environment, which doesn't nearby the shipping route.
Right.
So they will reduce the chance of the farm fish being exposed by the toxicants. For example, we always heard in BC coast there's oil spills.
Mm-hmm.
So all the farm will be all the way away from all the shipping of the oil.
Okay.
So it's kind of the location play a role.
So, so your research is focusing mostly on two species, correct?
Yes, by far.
And which are they?
So they are Atlantic salmon. That's an aquaculture species in North America and Norway. And the other one is European sea bass. That's the other aquaculture species in France.
Mm-hmm.
And believe it or not, it's kind of amazing that the two species in two geographic areas, they face the same challenges.
Yeah.
And they are both by climate change, the higher temperature and no oxygen in the water, and by anthropogenic pollution produced by the human.
Mm-hmm. So then do you see much genetic difference between the domesticated fish stocks that in aquaculture and the wild fish stocks of the same species?
The genetic difference is still under the way of research right now.
Okay.
We do see the phenotypic difference, but the difference in phenotype can be due to neither environment or genetics.
Right.
So it is a hot research topic to tease it apart. But in theory, a domesticated fish, for example, Atlantic salmon, they will select for example, high growth rate.
Mm-hmm.
The way we expect certain degrees of genetic difference, but it's really hard to quantify by how much.
Right. And so a lot of your research that you're doing now, I believe, if I have this correct, is looking at the respiratory system,
right,
of the fish.
It's cardiorespiratory, so
okay.
Heart.
Yeah. And so why is that so important, or why is that what you're looking into? What's that going to tell you?
So when you think about an animal, doesn't matter, human or fish, we all need to breathe in different ways.
Yeah.
And then the oxygen uptake kind of determines how active an animal is. So you can think about, so the cardiorespiratory system is like the central component of uptaking oxygen from environment and take it all the way delivered to the tissue level where you generate ATP, and it will translate to all kind of activities, swimming, migration, and reproduction.
Mm-hmm.
So this cardiorespiratory physiology, we can think of like the engine of a car. So there's so many components for a car, but if the engine is bad, then the car will have problem.
Right.
Same idea goes to the animals.
Right.
If the heart and gill, in fish's case, has trouble, they will have a hard time to survive.
So then when, with climate change or even with an oil spill, how can you explain briefly how something like an oil spill would impact fish in the long run or also in the short term as well?
Right.
What happens?
Well, the short-term effect, we can actually see it in the oil slick, they can clog the surface of the water body.
Yeah.
And that's really obvious. And then everybody will guess and know the fish will die when they swim into the oil slick.
Yeah.
But the interesting, the very interesting question is how those effect in long run. So I call it as a chronic residual effect of certain toxicants, for example, oil. So the one way it can impact fish is it will damage the gill. Then the question becomes how well the gill can recover after the oil contamination. And then at the same time, if the fish were running to no oxygen environment, the kind of broken gill will make them go through certain troubles.
Right.
And so they will become major use aerobic to use more anaerobic, and anaerobic is not sustainable.
Yeah. So then if you have a fish population that's been impacted by an oil spill or some kind of contamination, generations into the future, can you still see that they, their, I guess, ancestors would have been impacted by that?
Oh, this we really don't know. This is kind of research we call the epigenetics. So what's the improvements of the parents will affect offsprings.
Right.
But unfortunately, in fish world, we are not there yet. So we just start to look at the chronic residual effect. And I did this research in my master. So I think that's one of few research out there to look into the long-term effect. Generation-wise, I think that would be our future route
right.
to look into if the offspring can reproduce, can reproduce and swim as well.
So in your research overview, you've written, quote, commercially selective breeding of Atlantic salmon, primarily for rapid growth, may compromise cardiorespiratory robustness and its related phenotypes, mm-hmm. end quote. To test this, fish have gone through what you call exercise training.
Right.
And so how exactly does this work with fish? Like, how can you make fish exercise?
Yeah, it's a question I get asked a lot in conference. it's odd we say exercise fish. So it's actually very simple. So if you think about the human athletes, we put them on a treadmill, mm-hmm. and then we put a mask on their face, and then we measure ocean uptake and the CO2 excretions. And it's very similar to what we do on the fish. We made a fish treadmill. Instead of running belt, we're running water through a tunnel. So we call it a swimming flume. Uh-huh. So with the different water velocity, in the fish will swim in different speed.
Okay.
Then, so as meantime, we can measure ocean uptake, and that will give our an idea of their metabolic rate at the swimming speed they are at. So that was kind of research to kind of quickly quantify what's their cardiorespiratory robustness, instead of if we need to open fish up and look at each fish in agriculture, that won't be good because there won't be many alive fish left. So we need to create some non-invasive way to test how robust fish are.
And so, yeah, what exactly does it tell you? Like, how what does the robustness actually mean? And what's
so in the study I have done, I choose two criteria to quantify their robustness. So the first is how they perform aerobically in the normal ocean environment. So that will give us a total scope of their metabolic rate. Mm-hmm. So in general, a lower scope means there's no room for fish to perform all kind of activities that's necessary for their life history.
Okay.
So that's one. And the other is we kind of push the cardiorespiratory system to a limit by introduce a hypoxic environment. Hypoxic means a low oxygen level. So they will challenge how effective fish can uptake the ocean from the water, even though the water has no ocean content, mm-hmm. and to supply their metabolism.
So what then is the hoped outcome of your research, like in the long-term goal?
Right, so the long-term goal is we hope to have a breed of Atlantic salmon that have a high growth. At the meantime, they have a good cardiorespiratory robustness. So that will improve the survival in the whole production overall. Mm-hmm. And that's also a concern of a lot of customers have when they buy the fish in the grocery. They might think agriculture fish have a compromised animal welfare.
Yeah.
Undenying, but it's actually not. We actually care about how animals doing in the farm. So that's kind of the ultimate goal. The first, survival. Growth, and second is the public awareness, mm-hmm. of how much we care about fish welfare.
So do you think that farm fish could become the main source of seafood in the near future?
Probably not in the near future. Cause people always have the tradition of liking the wild salmon. Mm-hmm. It's in the culture embedded in our society. So it will always be wild and farm fish side by side.
Right.
What farm fish is important is the first, the human population is growing. We need a more high quality protein, and then more people are living in poverty. Right. So they want to have good food. Fish is one of really healthy and tasty food. More fish want to eat fish. But right now the fishery capture has been plateaued for last decade.
Right.
So how to meet this increasing demand? So we need to increase the products by farm those fish in a more more efficient way, mm-hmm. than just catch wild fish.
So yeah, we're almost out of time now. Do you have any, I guess, anything you would like to add or to tell the audience just about your research that we didn't touch on yet, or where they can find out more about what you're doing?
Oh, that would be great. So this aquaculture research actually lead me to a route into a fundamental science part. So the challenge we have now is we don't really have a good way to quantify the robustness or fitness of fish right now. So this kind of become my future direction. So in order to do that, I actually develop a paradigm called the integrated respiratory assessment paradigm. And that's the thing you can search in the scientific literature and they will pop out. And this kind of the future direction I will be heading into. And if you want to look into my research particularly or the comparative physiology group in the UBC, you can search Department of Zoology.UBC, and there will be some headline and news over there. Mm-hmm. And then you can find me on the website if you go to the graduate student, type my name in, and then some of my research will show up.
Awesome. Well, thank you for coming on the show, and good luck with the rest of your research.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Thanks.
Thank you, Yangfan. It's now time for Alex Norman's weekly financial segment.
This is the weekly financial update report with Alex Norman. Keep you updated with what's going on in the markets. These are this week's top stories for Thursday, April 6th to Thursday, April 13th, 2017. The Canadian government announces their plans to legalize cannabis. Tesla shares jump as Elon Musk teases their plans for their new commercial truck. The SEC goes after fake financial newsmakers. And Amazon founder announces plans to fund his rocket company. We begin this week's news with the Canadian government's tabling of legislation to end the prohibition of pot on Thursday. The plan comes with two new bills, one to regulate recreational use, sale, and cultivation of marijuana, and the second one to strengthen measures to stop impaired driving. In a Bloomberg report, analysts are estimating that the Canadian cannabis market will be worth approximately $6 billion by the year 2021. Shares of marijuana producers like Canopy Growth Corporation and Aurora Cannabis Inc. have surged more than fourfold over the past 12 months. However, a warning that the legislative process could drag on sent shares of Canopy Growth down 4% and shares in Aurora Cannabis down 7% on Thursday. Many of the big cannabis stocks also fell on Wednesday after the Globe and Mail reported that the federal government is getting ready to drastically speed up the licensing process for producers. Details from the federal government on prices, licensing fees, and taxes are expected to be announced in the coming months. Tesla's got a new ride, and this one's for the truck fans out there. Shares in Tesla jumped nearly 3% on Thursday after chief executive Elon Musk said the electric car company expects to unveil its planned commercial truck in September. Musk last year announced plans for electrical vehicles ranging from a commercial truck called the Tesla Semi, a public transportation bus, a pickup truck, and a compact sports utility vehicle. Quote, Tesla's semi-truck unveil is set for September. The team has done an amazing job. Seriously, next level, said Musk in a tweet on Thursday. Shares in Tesla have surged 41% to record highs this year, and this week the Silicon Valley company briefly became the largest U.S. car maker by market capitalization, beating out General Motors. Shares in Tesla closed up on Thursday at $304 a share for 1.77% gain for the week. Reader beware, the SEC has something to share. The U.S. Securities Exchange on Monday announced a crackdown against alleged stock promotion schemes in which writers were secretly paid to post hundreds of bullish articles about public companies on financial websites. 27 individuals and entities, including a Hollywood actress, were charged with misleading investors on websites such as Seeking Alpha and Wall Street Cheat Sheet. The Regular has identified more than 450 problem articles, of which more than 250 falsely say the writers were not being paid. 17 defendants, including Galena Biopharma Inc., Luminous Cellular Therapeuticals, and Lions Biotechnologies Inc., have agreed to pay more than $4.8 million and to refrain from further wrongdoing. The SEC has filed lawsuits against 10 other defendants in a Manhattan federal court.
Fly me to the moon, let me play
among the stars and let me see what spring is like on.
Well, Frank, your dreams may come true. Amazon.com founder Jeff Bezos said on Wednesday that he's selling about $1 billion worth of the internet retailer stock annually to fund his Blue Origin rocket company, which aims to launch paying customers on 11-minute space rides starting next year. Bezos is Amazon's largest shareholder, with a 17% stake in the company, worth $73.5 billion on Wednesday's closing price. Quote, ultimately, the plan is for Blue Origin to become a profitable, self-sustaining enterprise, with the long-term goal of cutting costs of spaceflight so that millions of people can live and work off Earth, said Jeff Bezos. Unmanned test flights have been underway since 2015. Shares in Amazon.com closed down on Thursday at $884.67 a share for a 1.52% loss for the week. Turning to the global markets, these are this week's numbers. Toronto's S&P TSX Composite Index was down this week with a loss of 1.04% to close at 15,535 points on Thursday. The S&P 500 Index closed lower this week with a loss of 1.19% to close at 2,329 points. The Nasdaq closed on Thursday with a gain of 1.04% for the week. In the European markets, the German DAX closed down 1%. In the Asian indices, the Japanese Nikkei posted a loss of 1.24%, and the Shanghai Composite was down 0.67% for the week. In the commodities market, May gold futures closed up this week at $1,287 an ounce. May crude futures were also up 2.82% for the week to close at $52.91 a barrel. In natural gas, May future contracts were down 2.12% to close at $3.23 a unit. In the bond market, yields for 10-year Canadian bonds are currently at 1.494%. U.S. 10-year Treasury yields closed lower this week at a rate of 2.237%. This has been the Weekly Financial Update Report with Alex Norman, keeping you updated with what's going on in the markets.
Thank you, Alex. That's our program for April 14th. Today's newscast was brought to you by talented volunteer efforts. If you would like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through Facebook, Twitter, or email us at news@citr.ca.
You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/radio/news/101. You can also find great content on our SoundCloud and Mixcloud pages. For more independent news, join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. Today's broadcast was produced by Andrew Seal. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening.
Hey, how you doing? This is Sean from Youth Brigade. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Hello. Hi. Do you want to go to a party with me?
No. The game's on.
Oh, I almost forgot. I'll be right there.
We like sports and we don't care who knows. From shooting hoops to the Super Bowl.
Do you like sports and don't care who knows? Then CITR Sports needs you. If you like sports, are into radio, or generally just want to have a great time, then come join us. Email our sports coordinator at sports101@citr.ca to find out more, or come by the station in the new sub. See you soon.
Watch, cause I'm the man.
Hey, this is Noah from Christ on Parade, and you are listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, BC, Canada. Where's that?
Dallas.